Well, the multi-million-dollar production Harry Potter and the Cursed Child has just opened at the glorious Princess Theatre in Melbourne, and the audiences, well, they just love it.
Mind-blowing, hey. So the intonation, how tight they are with transitions and, like, the effects and the way that they... Oh, I can't even describe.
So good, it, yeah.
You just... You're not ready for it.
It blows
you're
honestly your mind. Not.
I was actually thinking in there that this is my favourite way to experience Harry Potter. I wish that it was something that more worlds or pieces of fiction did, because it's just a completely new experience and in a world that you already know that you love.
Yeah, I love that it plays on using your imagination how the books did, and yet it's less literal than the movie.
Is this your first time at the theatre?
I've only been like once before, and I've finally like kind of started to get into it, so yeah, that's earlier.
It makes you want more.
Yes, it certainly does make you want more. Hannah Riche talking to Happy Punters there. I'm predicting this will run for years. Right now, tickets are on sale right through to February 2020. The London production premiered in 2016. It won 9 Olivier Awards, including Best New Play. The Broadway production won 6 Tonys, including Best Play. And Melbourne's only the 3rd city in the world to have this show. Actually, it's 2 shows. Each one is about 2.5 hours long, and you can either see them in one day, have a dinner break in the middle, or you can do it across 2 nights. So it's a big commitment. It's directed by John Tiffany, who devised the story with J.K. Rowling, the creator of Harry Potter, of course, and playwright Jack Thorne. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael.
Your recent credits include Pinocchio for London's National Theatre and that beautiful musical Once, which won heaps of awards as well. Also with us are Harry Potter and Ginny Weasley. They're played by Gareth Reeves.
Hi, Michael.
And Lucy Golby.
Hello, Michael.
Nice to have you here. John, why bring Harry Potter to the stage at all? What's the core idea here?
Well, I was approached with the idea, so I'd like to stake claim to that idea, but it was Sonia Friedman and Colin Callender, our producers, who had a thought and approached J.K. Rowling, who had been approached by many, many people over the years, including Michael Jackson, apparently. She was invited to Neverland, but didn't go. One of the ideas was to turn each of the books into a musical, which would have been 7 musicals. And I think Joe was like, I'm going nowhere near theatre if that's what they're going to do with my work. Anyway, and then that all settled down and she was on to writing other things. And Sonia and Colin went to see her and said, we'd love to explore the idea of Harry as a grown-up man, as a father, and Ginny and Ron and Hermione, and see how they're getting on after the last book finishes. There's a chapter called 19 Years Later where you see them sending their kids off to Hogwarts, and Harry and Ginny's middle kid is called Albus Severus. There's a clue there as to his fate. And so she loved that idea, and then they approached me, and I think they were thinking like almost a psychological exploration of Harry being an orphan, never having parents, and then becoming a parent himself, almost with like one chair at the Royal Court. And I was like, no. If we're going to put Harry Potter on stage, it can't become dull. Not that that would necessarily be dull, but I knew that a lot of the audience would be first-time theatregoers. And I wanted to create a story that was as epic as the books.
So, Gareth, as John is saying, this is Harry Potter, the next generation. Harry's now a dad. And he's become rather staid, a man for the ministry wearing a suit. What's preoccupying him at the start of the show? We're not going to give anything away, but at the start, what's on his mind?
Well, I think he's like every busy father with a full-time, you know, ministry job. Like, he's exactly as you'd expect. He's completely snowed under. It's peacetime, but, you know, under Hermione, they're still working hard to maintain what they've fought very hard for.
Hermione has become the Minister for Magic.
That's right.
He's the head of magical law enforcement.
Yeah, that's right. So he's essentially now the police commissioner underneath the Prime Minister, both veterans of a terribly devastating war.
He's become a very serious dude. If he didn't have the round glasses, I wouldn't have recognised him.
Yeah, he's got a lot on his plate, Michael. And yeah, we meet him right at the start when we pick up exactly where we left off in the books. That epilogue from the final book, The Deathly Hallows, is the first scene of our play. We literally launch off from the last time we saw these people. And yeah, it goes on from there.
Yeah, and Albus is his son.
Yeah.
And he's about to go off to Hogwarts in his father's footsteps. And poor old Albus, he feels like such an ordinary boy, even for a wizard. And I suppose that's his anguish. Famous damn dad who did the whole damn thing before I was even born in the olden days when evil stalked the cosmos. Now, these are such ordinary times and dad's
Yeah, you know. Well, that's exactly it. And how do you make your way in the world with all of that on top of you? Now, he's got an older brother, James, who went before him, who did everything right, Quidditch captain, all the rest, and Lily, who's coming after him, who's just a ray of sunshine, and poor Albus just stuck right in the middle there.
Ah, poor kid. So, Lucy, you're Ginny, who it must be said is terribly patient with Harry. What worries her most in part one? What's her driver?
Well, I think it's quite similar. I mean, they've grown up, they're parents now. Parenting is very difficult, and they're at that point of transition with their own children, which is they're moving into a new world. They're moving into a world away from home, so you don't have that kind of constant supervision anymore. And I think it's really that time when kids are trying to work out who they are as individuals and how do you distinguish yourself from your family anyway, let alone when it's such a public family. Like, they're all celebrities.
You're going to do a scene for us. Can you set this up? What are we going to see?
So this is quite early in the play. They've just dropped the kids to Hogwarts, to get on the Hogwarts Express. And it's that night, isn't it?
It is. And just before dropping Albus off at Hogwarts as well, I think it's important to say that Albus and I had a bit of we kind of bumped heads a little bit. I tried to give him a very special gift to say, a night before Hogwarts gift. I gave one to each of the kids and I tried to give something very special to Albus and literally threw it back in my face.
I really related to this scene because if you've been a parent or a school teacher, you will have heard yourself saying the most appallingly scripted things that come from some ancient source or deep in your DNA, and you think, I'm behaving like a total Burke to this kid, but I can't stop saying things. I remember the time when I was a school teacher and I said to a child, son, you're wasting my time and the time of the entire class. And I thought, it's come to this. I wish the ground would open and swallow me up. And he's in that territory, isn't he?
He is. You open your mouth, your father comes out. I have that all the time. But of course, Harry, never had a father, which is part of his problem, is that he's, like he says later on, I'm operating without wires. I'm trying desperately to be this idea of father. And of course, Ginny is the perfect person to pull him up on that all the time.
All right, let's hear it. So this is the scene where it's the middle of the night, the children have been packed off to school, Albus is off to confront whatever destiny awaits him, and Harry wakes up having had a nightmare.
Harry?
Fine, I'm fine. Go back to sleep.
Lumos. A nightmare?
Yeah.
About what?
The Dursleys. Well, it started there, then it became something else.
Do you want a sleeping draught?
No, I'm fine. Go back to sleep.
You don't seem fine. Can't have been easy with Amos Diggory.
The anger I can cope with. The fact he's right is harder. Amos lost his son because of me.
That doesn't seem particularly fair on yourself.
There's nothing I can say. Nothing I can say to anyone. Unless it's the wrong thing, of course.
So, that is what's upsetting you. The night before Hogwarts, it's never a good night if you don't want to go. Giving Al the blanket was a nice try.
Went pretty badly wrong from there. I said some things, Ginny.
I heard.
And you're still talking to me?
Because I know that when the time is right, you'll say sorry. That you didn't mean it. That what you said concealed other things. You can be honest with him, Harry. That's all he needs.
I just wish he was more like James or Lily.
Yeah, maybe don't be that honest.
No, I wouldn't change a thing about him. I can understand them and...
And Albus is different. And isn't that a good thing? And he can tell, when you're putting on your Harry Potter front. He wants to see the real you.
The truth is a beautiful and terrible thing. And should therefore be treated with great caution. Dumbledore.
Strange thing to say to a child.
Not when you believe that child might have to die to save the world.
Harry, what's wrong?
Fine, I'm fine. I hear you. I'll try to...
Does your scar hurt?
No, I'm fine. Now knock that. Harry, let's get some sleep.
How long has it been since your scar hurt?
22 years.
Oh, you nailed that. Yeah, the scar. We all the audience thinking, no, the scar is hurting. There's something Voldemortian stirring in the cosmos. Gareth Reeves and Lucy Goldby. They play Harry Potter and Ginny Weasley in Harry Potter and the Cursed Child. I keep wanting to say the Cursed Child.
Some people do.
Do they?
You can say whatever you like, Michael.
I will. It's my show. Yeah. Cursed Child, let it be. It's just opened at the Princess Theatre in Melbourne, and they're here with director John Tiffany. So, Gareth, this is a big role, one associated with a particular actor. How did you prepare for this?
Oh, gosh. I came at it from many, many angles because there's a lot to it. There's a lot to unpack. I mean, you know, the guy is a like I said earlier, a combat veteran in a time of peace, a very carefully sustained peace. I sort of explored that and post-traumatic stress disorder and these kind of ideas as related to the nightmares. I just dug deep into being a father and family. I watched interviews of police commissioners giving press conferences. I also, you know, have some very specific kind of physical challenges. We did pretty extensive kind of boot camps, dialect classes. I read, of course, the books again and pulled everything out that I could. I watched a lot of interviews with Joe Rowling
And what does he want? I mean, at his core, what does Harry Potter want?
Family, I think. He wants to be loved and to give love, I think.
And so his greatest fear is?
Isolation and loneliness and failure. But I think he's also like this. The brilliant thing about this play as well is that he's moving into a new chapter in his life and he's learning some new and really important lessons. And I think up until this play, till this play starts, he's been someone who's wanted to fix everything. He's a fixer and he is at his most happy and contented when he's able to do things and make changes. And he's forced in this play to have to accept that maybe he can't fix everything.
Mm. John, what was the writing process?
It was kind of amazing and kind of bizarre. And, you know, I kept having to kind of pinch myself. The first time that Jack and I'd met Joe already, and then I introduced Jack to the project. And
so Joe is J.K. Rowling.
Sorry, Joe is J.K.
We know her
Rowling,
as J.K., yeah. But you now know her as Joe.
Yeah. That was they called her J.K. because they didn't want the readers to identify her as male or female. Ah. Because they thought men sold more books.
Oh, well, now we know
how wrong they were.
That's not true.
No.
Yep.
And I took Jack up to Edinburgh where Joe lives and introduced them. And so
Jack Thorne is an exceedingly tall and very talented playwright.
Incredibly talented, yeah. And I've worked with him before and I've known him for years. And I introduced the two of them and we sat down and started talking. And within about 5 minutes, we were working out what Hermione's job was and whether Ginny was still writing, about Quidditch. And we were like, no, let's make her the sports editor. And I went to the bathroom at one point and I was like, and we're actually deciding between us the fate of the, you know, characters from the most beloved literary franchise of all time. And then I kept coming back in very, you know, like, this isn't anything at all. You know, I do this every day. You know, I was with J.R. Tolkien last week. And, but, you know, I've actually got all the notebooks. I thought, I need to write all this down, and I've got the notebooks still where.
The great thing about the decisions you made in that room is that you were not reverential towards what had already happened. Because no. I'm not giving anything away by saying at the end of part one, you cannot believe how much of the Harry Potter universe you think you know has been destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you have to come back for part two. Because Lucy, you just can't believe it.
You can't believe it. It's great actually hearing the differences between the people that are there for part one and part two on the same day, and then the people that have come for part one on Thursday night and then have to wait all day Friday to come back for part two, and meeting them on the Friday night and people saying, I couldn't go to work or I couldn't go to school and it's been so stressful and, you know, I've been doing this, I had to go to yoga, just all day being able to cogitate on what's happening and how it happened and where on earth we're going to come back to in part two.
If you're a writer and someone has told you that your cliffhanger has to go because cliffhangers are old fashioned, come and see this show because it's got a fabulous cliffhanger. Well, a cliffhanger is at every break, but the cliffhanger at the end of part one is just unbelievable.
It was an amazing kind of moment when Jack and I, there's two moments in the story that Jack and I did not think that Joe would let us do. And she embraced them with open arms and ran towards her screaming, yeah.
Yeah.
And the end of part one was the first one. And that's when I realized it was going to have to be longer than a regular play because I knew I couldn't get to that point in the story in an hour. Or a quarter, an hour and a quarter or something, not without doing an abbreviated version of the characters. And, theatre tells story quite slowly compared to film. It needs breath, it needs air, you can't do kind of jump cut edits like you can in film. And film eats up story. So I knew we were going to have to tell it properly and longer than a normal play.
Well, if you do jump cut your way through the first 4 years at Hogwarts.
Ruthlessly. Well, that's so I could get to adult actors.
Yeah, where it really matters, yeah. I mean, the great thing about this show is that it is wholeheartedly a stage show. It's not a movie on screen. It's not Disney on ice. It's not even a musical. It's a very old-fashioned form. It's a stage show with magic tricks in it that would have been seen in the Princess Theatre back in 1880. I mean, these are old school magic tricks done with a slickness you've never seen done before. But if you know your magic, you recognise every move, except for the clever thing they do with the lights, which I finally worked out that makes everything, I mustn't say, but there's a very clever thing and it's the lights that are doing it.
It's not actually.
What is it? Come on, it's the lights.
Not, it's not the lights. Is it the lights?
#keep the secret.
It's only the lights or else the whole set's made of jelly and somebody wobbles it.
That's closer. It's related to light, but it's not light. It's not light. But yeah, no, it's that was. I mean, that's my taste is actually quite analog and acoustic. And yeah. Like when I did once the musical, it was it was the most. I think it was the most complicated sound design that had ever been on Broadway or in a musical, and yet that was only to make it sound acoustic.
Yeah.
And it's the same with this. You know, I wanted my brief to all the design team was that I want to create things that kids can do at home. I want to build trains out of suitcases. I want you to be able to, go into your mum's big coat and flap around like a cape, like a wizard, and turn into somebody else through Polyjuice, etc. Of course, I wouldn't want kids to do a lot of what we do at home, but I do like rough magic. That is my kind of that's my taste. That's my kind of. Yeah. Happy place.
And well, it's so slick. It's so beautiful. Could this change the industry? I mean, I'm talking about the commercial theatre because commercial theatre these days just means big musicals. You've gone into a space that, the theatre you're using now was previously occupied by Book of Mormon, Les Mis was there, and you'll be followed by another commercial musical unless you're changing the game by putting on a stage play. Could this change the industry?
Does the industry need changing in a way? I don't know but I wouldn't claim to be a kind of, the person to want or, have the power to do that. What I do know is that Joe, and I only realised latterly that Joe was very, very clever, as she always been, in terms of what she was doing, telling the eighth story in a different medium. It's kind of unheard of that she writes seven books, they're all filmed into eight films, and then she decides to tell the eighth and last story because when we see Harry in the last scene, Harry and Albus together in the last scene, she said very early on, that is the last we'll ever hear from Harry Potter. And it always gives me chills when I watch Gareth, and Sean there and I go, that's it, that's Harry Potter's last moment with his audience. And she said everything she wanted to say and she let Jack write it, and so I think she thought, well, she loves theatre, but she's never worked in theatre. And I think she was probably thinking, okay, I've got lots of young kids reading books, particularly boys who weren't reading them. I wonder if we can get them into the theatre now. So she might have had that question, but she's never made any claim to that. She's incredibly a humble woman.
Do you know who's coming to the show? Is it a core of Harry Potter readers, or is your demographic broader than that?
It's much broader. It's 70% first-time theatre goers. I don't know. You meet them more than I do.
Sure do.
Are they Harry Potter?
Oh, it's such a wonderful mixture. There's people who have bought the published script when it came out, but never read it, and have brought it along to see the show and then read it, or people who have read it and then brought all their family and love the fact that they know everything and their family doesn't, or mum's come along, she's never read anything, and or there's people out there covered in like tattoos of the Hogwarts castle on their back, and or dressed in full robes, and it's a complete mixture. But across the board, people are, what I'm getting from people at Stage Door is just this gratitude to see these people again, these people that they hold so close and so dearly to their hearts. They're just so happy to see them talking and walking again. You know?
We got to stop. John, Lucy, Gareth, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
John Tiffany is director of Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, parts 1 and 2. It's just opened at Melbourne's Princess Theatre. Tickets are on sale through to February next year. It really is fabulous. You also met Gareth Reeves, who plays Harry Potter, and Lucy Golby, who plays Ginny Weasley. I'm Michael Cathcart, and this is The Stage Show, where everything is done with jelly.